free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.
Welcome to Deep Dive Genre. Director, writer, and actor Steve Hudson was born in London and grew up in Britain and South America. He began writing, directing, and acting at Cambridge University and worked in theatre and comedy in the UK, Italy, Germany, Cuba, and Belgium. Steve began working in film and TV in Germany in 1996, acting in a variety of productions from soap operas to feature films. He wrote and directed Goodbye, which won the UIP Award for Best European Short Film at the Venice Film Festival and the German Short Film Prize in Silver. This was followed by his first feature-length film, True North, in 2006 and co-directing on the BBC miniseries Cranford in 2008. A longtime voice actor and voice director, Steve made the jump to animation writing and directing Stitchhead, his first animated feature, which premiered at the Annecy Film Festival in 2025. We talked to Steve via video call for this interview. Steve, welcome to Deep Dive Genre.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I'm going to start with a couple of more general questions, and then I'd like to do a deep dive into your film Stitchhead, Alles voller Monster, and also talk about voice acting as well.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit about your journey to becoming a director?
Loaded question. Yeah. Well, I think my first production is Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And from where we were living, I must have been five at the oldest, but it was my sister was Snow White and all our cuddly toys were the dwarves.
Okay.
It's quite difficult to get everybody on and off stage, I seem to remember, but we did that in our parents' bedroom. I've always kind of liked telling stories and, you know, having fun like that. I was fortunate in Britain at the time when I went to school. It's less common these days, which I strongly regret. There was lots of theatre. I was able to start directing even at school, which was super, and was acting in loads of plays as well, which is something certainly my kids haven't been able to do at school so much, which I just feel is a huge loss. And then at university, you know, we have in Britain three terms in every university year. Mm-hmm. And I was doing like two or three plays every term. So I was just really, I was a theatre kid. I'm sorry, so my shame, but I really enjoyed it and had fun. And that was the most important thing. And can try out loads and loads of different stuff, which is cool. You know, so doing like very serious, very experimental work, you know, lots of comedy, and really enjoyed that. And so I just went sort of naturally from there into theatre. And then when I migrated to Germany at the end of the 90s, I ended up quite quickly doing film and television because I needed to pay the rent. And that was really cool. And I was able to get lots of experience there. I did a short film sort of off my own bat with support from the Cologne Film House, which is a little institution here, where they had a little bit of money to buy a film role, because back then it was like done on film, which was so exciting. And then I got a job. I'd been acting in a TV soap opera, and I got a job for the same company directing another TV soap opera. Mm-hmm. And that's a real baptism by fire, because you have about 25 minutes to shoot each scene, which is just insanely, insanely quick. So any time you watch a soap opera, especially like a daily soap, you think that doesn't look altogether great, or maybe the actors aren't perfect. That's just because, like, literally the first take, there was a mic in the picture, and then the second take, the camera went the wrong way, and the third take, like, you got to accept it, whatever happens. So, because you got to move on. So I learned loads. I did that for about nearly a year, I think. At the same time, like, it wasn't really my world. I didn't ever watch soap operas. Yeah, and I was able then to do another short, which won a prize at Venice, and so that kind of was enabled me to, you know, go on and make features, which was cool.
How do you choose the stories, or how do you commit to a project? How does that process usually work?
I usually write and direct. So the films that I've done, I've written myself. So on the one hand, the thing that frustrated me as an actor is you're always just got to interpret the material you're delivered. And so, you know, actors are always hoping they'll get a good script and a good part. And you're very much at the mercy of, you know, unless you're insanely good and insanely successful, which I was not. You know, you're at the mercy of kind of what you get. So I really enjoy writing, but I really, I'm having written it, the thought of, oh, someone else can direct it is kind of hard. A lot of writers are more introverted. 90% of direction is basically being a traffic cop. You stand here, you do this. It's just logistics. And it's sometimes very overwhelming, but I kind of enjoy that, just the organizing. And then because you can really, no, like this and do that, you know. So for me, the big thing then is really for me to commit to directing something is usually because I've written it. And so then if I'm writing it and I want to say something from the heart, it feels to me that there's, you know, these days we've got wall-to-wall content everywhere, bearing down at us from every side. And so if I'm going to do something, this is something that I really want to say, that there's a message in there that maybe it's not for everybody, but I hope really connects with some people, that is heartfelt, that is, you know, my reaction to the world and the way this world is going.
Yeah. How did you come across Stitchhead? Because it's a children's book. Is it like a comic book? How would you describe the source material and what made you decide to turn it into an animated movie?
So Stitchhead is a book by an English-based author who lives in London called Guy Bass, which was originally written for young people. So I'd say it's probably a sort of reading age of 8 to 12, but probably sort of from 8 or 8 years old or something, you can enjoy it. Mm-hmm. It's originally a book, a printed book with a few illustrations in, but like every few pages. Since then, Guy and his illustrator, Pete Williamson, have created a graphic novel, which is much more of a comic book kind of thing, which is also super cool. I recommend anybody go and get it. We actually first encountered Stitchhead as an audiobook in the German translation, which was read by the amazing German actress, Katharina Thalbach, who is intensely talented and did all the voices. And we were, it was a long time ago, so we got it on a CD. And we were in the car and we put this CD on, and I've got 3 kids, we're all listening to it. And it was like fascinating and we were all really gripped by it. And the super cool things about the story as we encountered it were, well, there were two things. So one is the genre. It's essentially a take on the Frankenstein story. Mm-hmm. I think none of my kids at that time had ever seen like a Frankenstein film certainly not read the Frankenstein book. But as soon as you see there's a castle high on the mountain above a little village, and in the castle there's a mad professor in a mad laboratory and he makes monsters, everybody gets it. Yeah, you know, as soon as the villagers form an angry mob with torches and pitchforks, big trouble is coming. So there's a whole kind of world out there, but you kind of plug into that super quickly, which is great, because I've been thinking about doing an animated film for a long time with my wife, who's also the producer on the film, Sonia Evers. And we've been looking for something which just kind of really inspired us like that. And so with this kind of story, with that Frankenstein genre, you don't need to explain a lot of the backstory. In a lot of animated films, like the world is new and it's kind of made up and there are weird rules to it. And it takes quite a lot of time. Oh, well, there's a magic tree, but you've got to get the magic bird, and the magic bird only comes if you've got the magic seed. And it's like, oh, it takes forever, you know, get on with it. Whereas with this, castle, mountain, village, monsters, bang, we're at the, you know, off to the races. So that was super cool. The second thing was then with that Frankenstein genre, you can play with all those cinematic genres. You know, there's so much fun you can have as a director. So like, I really like Chicken Run, the Aardman stop motion movie, but which is based, if you know The Great Escape, which is one of these prisoner of war escape movies, is based very, very closely on The Great Escape. And they play with all the cinematic genre there, and that's exactly what we wanted to do here. So it sort of felt okay, there's super humor to be had in that, and with the humor which Guy has with the genre as well in the original book and in the illustrations as well by Pete. And thirdly, the thing that really stuck with me were the characters. So Stitchhead is this kid, and he's a kid who's been left with adult responsibilities, who's essentially been abandoned by his father and has to look after this whole castle full of the other monsters who are his brothers and sisters. And that was really touching. And you could tell that there's some sort of real biographical feeling. And Guy said so himself in an interview we did together. There's a lot of him in there. And I reacted to that very strongly as well. And certainly, you know, I think childhood is a lot tougher than we adults like to think it is. And this thing of children being left alone, and it's, on the one hand, it's like the ultimate freedom, but on the other hand, it's the ultimate fear. And a lot of the best animated movies are sort of children without adults, you know, from way back from the first Disney's, you know, children without adults is you've got to sort it out yourself. And Stitchhead is, he's got to sort it out himself. And so that emotional kind of hook, you care about this little guy, which I thought was fantastic. And at the same time, especially in the original book, like Creature, who's his best friend, or as Creature puts it, his bestest best friend, is so full of love and loyalty. He's like, you know, the best friend you could ever possibly have. And that appealed to me so much. And I thought that if you've got characters like that, that you really care about, and you really love, and you want to succeed, that's the thing that really touches you and stays with you, maybe long after the film. Because the danger is there are so many films around today, you know, you see one and tomorrow you've forgotten it. And you want things that really touch people and mean something.
And you worked with Guy on the script. Can you tell us a little bit about that process? And also, I would be interested, was there ever a conflict between sort of the writer you and the director you?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, well, there's a conflict between me and Guy.
No. I hope not.
Guy was incredibly modest and generous in the whole process. Because I say, and it was really, and you feel a lot of his personality. He understood that in the process of making a film, changes have to be made. And he just said, go ahead and do it. And was incredibly positive about the changes we made, which I'd be very nervous about.
Yeah, that is very lucky and also, dare I say it, unusual.
It is extremely unusual. I'd like to think at least it's because what I reacted to in the script were the things that originally moved Guy. And you have cases of sometimes of movies, like a book that I loved to death as a kid was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And when they made the movie of that, they just didn't really like the book. I think that's a mistake, you know, and they tried to make another movie, in which case, go make your other movie.
Yeah.
You know, I love this book, so I wanted to kind of do it justice on its own terms. Now, there were some changes we needed to make. Like the first was the book was too short.
Mm-hmm.
A movie can't be 35 minutes long. And that's what it was looking like. So we, in the original book, Stitchhead's in the castle and he's feeling lost and ignored. And then this circus director, Fullbutt Freakfinder, comes to the castle and gets into the castle immediately. And it turns out that his promises were very empty. Now, we had this situation in the book. There's so much emphasis on love. You know, the circus director promises they'll love you. Mm. But we wanted to explore that. It seems to me that today, you know, kids, all of us now, you know, we've got a phone in our pockets and we get little notifications every time someone gives us a thumbs up or a heart or a like or a retweet, yeah, or whatever it might be. And love has become a metric. It's become a number. And, you know, oh, I got 1,000 views on YouTube. I got 1,000,000 views. And it's whatever the number is, it's never enough. That is not love. And so it seemed to me that the promise of showbiz, of going out into the world and, you know, becoming loved and famous in that sense was really important, because it was kind of the seed of that was in the book already, even though, because for the length of the children's book, that had been too long, Guy didn't explore it that much. So in our version, we've got a middle act, an act two, where Stitchhead leaves the castle and actually becomes a star in this quite macabre freak show that this circus director has. And we discover that the love of show business, you know, spoiler alert, is not really love in its pure form. And then to your second question, sort of conflict within me between writing as a writer and writing as a director, is that...
Yeah.
Screenwriting, you've just got to always make it short and to the point, because you want people to read it at the speed that shit. So you need short, concise sentences. And sometimes as a writer, you know, you get carried away by the, oh, and you get, and then afterwards you've got to go through adjective, out. And so that's the main thing, just to keep it concise. Yeah.
Obviously, you mentioned that now there's a graphic novel, and the book originally had a few illustrations as well. In regards to the visual aspect, how did you and Guy approach that?
So the original drawings in the book, which are really wonderful by Pete Williamson, are they're kind of little handmade, very scratchy. They're pen and ink drawings. So it's a lot of black ink. And so you have the black of the shadows of the castle. Now, some of the elements of the design, we took one-to-one. So Stitchhead is basically as he's drawn in the book. What we found, though, is that with that pen and ink drawing, going one-to-one into 3D animation where you're immersed in a cinematic experience, it became too dark and overwhelming for a younger audience. So we wanted to, you know, our film is basically for kids six and up, you know, so it's not for young kids, but it's for kids six and up, and then also their parents. So we wanted something that kind of works for both groups. And if it was just very dark like that, it just became a bit too horrific and intimidating, which wasn't going to work, you know, just to, because if you see one picture on every four or five pages, that's one thing. But if you're in that world all that time with all those shadows, that didn't work. So what we took was, we took this, the use of the black, but we started off literally by taking Pete's black and white drawings and then adding like primary colors. So when I was growing up as a kid in Britain in the 80s, we were really into punk. We all wanted to be punk rockers. And we'd have jumpers like this. It was like red and black or green and black or blue and black or yellow and black. But we sort of had these big primary colors, but always with kind of black splashed in. And so that's how we started off with Stitchhead's costume and then with the shadows of the castle, but just like filling it up with these primary colors. But then at the same time, which is also a very punky aesthetic, which is also there in Pete's drawings, it's like everything is kind of hand-drawn and handmade. So there's no kind of really straight line. The Austrian Hundertwasser says the straight line is the invention of the devil. But everything looks kind of wonky and slightly out of shape and out of form. And like, you know, nothing is, it's like everything is kind of not quite functioning perfectly. And sort of there's all, every little wheel in a machine, would there be a little squeak or a clunk? And everything is kind of unique and individual. So it's not like a mass produced world. And it's then the same thing then going on to design all the monsters. Everything's kind of all pushed together and mashed together in some different ways, which nearly fits but not quite.
Can you tell us your favorite scene from the film and maybe give our listeners a little bit of a behind the scenes background? I know it's hard. You shouldn't have favorites, but
it's like asking me to choose my favorite. To choose my favorite child. It's like, no. Well, there are lots of funny scenes. I hope there are scenes where, you know, we get everybody laughing out loud in this cinema, and that's always kind of a great thing, because that's kind of the proof. You know, like if they don't laugh, they don't laugh, and if they laugh, they laugh. So that's, you know, my training, whatever. But in live comedy, you know, that's, you know, you can do serious theater, and at the end, everyone says, "Oh, that was really interesting." But if you do a comedy, if they laugh, they laugh, and if they don't, they don't, and that's that. So the laugh's always good, but I think probably the things that in the end I treasure the most are the moments where people are really moved. And it's, you know, it's not everybody. If you're watching it, but you're looking at your phone at the same time and eating a meal, then it's probably not going to impact you in the same way as, let's say, you're in a movie theater and, yeah, and it's, you know, and it's just the day when suddenly you're really thinking about your life and then something speaks to you from the screen. It's always different for different people. I think there's a scene at the end of the film where the professor, the mad professor, who in our setup, he's just been creating mad monster after mad monster, but he then just goes on to create another one. That's what he does. He's an artist, but he's kind of obsessive compulsive, and he is a terrible parent. Like the original Frankenstein, he doesn't really care about what's happening to these monsters, and he kind of leaves it to Stitchhead to look after them. And there's a scene at the end where he finally sees, he's actually brought face to face with his children, and he sees them for the first time and remembers them and says their names. And we had to show the whole film quite early in the process as a test screening. To an audience of kids in Los Angeles, well, in Burbank, California.
Yeah.
It was like for the investors, they wanted to know, is it going to work for an audience? And this was at this stage, the film as it was literally just a storyboard. So it's a bunch of black and white sketches, you know, one after another, maybe a new sketch every two or three sketches a second or something, but it's like incredibly basic. So it's not 3D animation, it's just rough drawings. And you know, and this is like an 85 minute movie, and I thought, oh my god, we're gonna die and the investors are gonna hate it, and then we're gonna, and at the beginning of the film the lights went down and we'd explained to the kids at the end it's going to look like this, and we showed them all these nice and bright colors and amazing sort of wonderful high resolution 4K imagery. but right now it's going to look this. And now we're going, fine, got it, popcorn. And then the lights went down and it began. And there was just this little voice came out of the darkness, said, "Oh, no, it's black and white." I just thought, oh my God, we're so going to die. But they loved it. Maybe people shouldn't go to the expense of, making these huge animated films, because we were able to get away with showing them the storyboard. And this final scene where the absent father finally sees his kids and recognizes them in what I assume is probably one of the patchwork family capitals of the world, you know, in LA, there's a lot of people who, you know, things happen. And you could have heard a pin drop.
Yeah.
It was absolute silence. And this kind of moment where the kids kind of saw themselves and they saw this thing. And afterwards, they have to sort of fill out all these kind of forms and what they liked and didn't like. But they get to write a couple of comments. And this kind of really stuck with them. And there was one little girl, and I don't know her name. All I know is that she lives in or near Burbank, and she was 11 years old. And she said, "I don't feel very loved in my life.
Oh, God.
So I'm really, really happy that it was a happy ending."
Yeah.
You know, and I certainly, and there are parts of my childhood which I found difficult. You know, but when you read that and someone's kind of written that down anonymously in the dark for you to see, and, you know, this film is kind of for her. And if there's something in the film that can give her the strength maybe to see through difficult times, even if it's just one kid in the audience that day, then it's worth it. You know, then it's worth it, because it's entertaining and there are songs, there are lots of colors and lots of jokes and stuff. But if there's something that someone's going to take away, and actually life is bearable and we can do this and we can make it, then, you know, then it's worth it.
Absolutely. A few years ago, I had a scholarship from the Akademie für Kindermedien with my own project, and they do the same thing. Basically, once you're sort of like two-thirds through the program, you go into a class and you pitch your story. You realize how attuned they are to certain aspects of stories.
Well, I think kids are smarter than we usually give them credit for, or a lot of the media made for kids gives them credit for. And I think they're emotionally often smarter than we are.
Absolutely.
You know, because we have ways of dealing with the world and dealing with things. And we're in a world where we're used to stepping over homeless people. You know, it's that bad.
Yeah.
And kids aren't. Is he okay? You know, kids will look and they don't know how to react. And we're just meant to walk out. And kids react emotionally. And it's important that we kind of serve them emotionally, to kind of take the world seriously, because they're looking at it with open eyes and open minds in a way that we are constantly liable to forget.
Children's media, that whole world is interestingly very specific in certain things that they think that children want.
Which
I have to say I don't agree with.
let's say, like, German TV often doesn't want anything uncomfortable.
And the book world, the same. I mean, I had a project that I pitched and I was told very specifically, well, you know, in that age bracket, usually around that time, it's all about first love for girls. I'm like, I'm sure there are a lot of girls who are not interested in first love when they're 11. The discussions you have, you just sit there and you're like, I just don't understand.
Yeah, but the themes that are dished up are often because they're somehow considered safe. Whereas love, if you to be totally honest about it, is usually absolutely destructive and appalling experience. And let's be honest, I do not wish to repeat that experience. It wasn't good. And suffering, the way that people want to avoid suffering and make things, because that serves their image of, oh, childhood is this really happy time and it's all cool. And then, you know, and then they become adults and then it's difficult. And it's actually the other way around, because kids, as an adult, at least you can deal with stuff. You know, if things are unpleasant, you can, well, look, I can move out. Right?
Yeah.
If you're a kid, you can't move out.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
And the failure of those responsible for children's media to kind of want to grapple with this stuff, to give kids the tools to deal with things that are difficult, is because we don't actually want to admit. It's like, you know, like people before used to think, oh, you know, the people in Global South living in terrible poverty, oh, they don't feel suffering like us. You know, it was just a very convenient lie.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to think, now, Stitchhead is not a massive downer of a film, but it does want to try and take children's suffering, or that thing of like Stitchhead being responsible for the others. It wants to try and take it seriously, you know, so there is actually, you know, something difficult that we're trying to talk about as well in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not like, hey, it's just 90 minutes of happy clappy, because it's just like a sugar rush in the end.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you feel like you haven't eaten anything nutritious.
What was your biggest takeaway from that production process? Because as you mentioned earlier, it's not your first film, but it's certainly your first animation film and your first children's project.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Well, the first thing is, the first major difference is it takes a long time. It took us 5 years in production.
Wow.
So we first encountered material 10 years ago, and then with like getting the rights and writing the script and getting it financed, that took 5 years, and then another 5 years to make the movie.
Wow.
So that's a long, you're in for a long haul. So you really want to do something that you really care about and you think is worthwhile. The other thing, people in animation are generally very nice. You know, because there's a certain extent in live action where like coal miners, just, they used to get coal lung. That was just kind of like a disease of the profession. And certainly a certain amount of ego and vanity is important in live action because, you know, the actor who says, no, it's fine. I'll take any costume. I was like that. It looks great, you know, and it's a terrible costume. Whereas like the really diva-like actors who say, I will not go out wearing that, you know, and actually they're right. And at the same time, it makes them quite difficult to work with. They protect their, and in horrible sort of modern parlance, their brand, but they, you know, they protect what's important. Whereas in animation, because kind of everybody's behind the scenes, the thing of like working together as a team and working for the greater good, and very modestly, and you know, an animator can work for weeks on a few seconds of material, and that it takes a humility and a dedication that I just bow down before. And there are so many other people, there are so many technical stages who work so hard, you know, just to, it's like people making a cathedral, you know, it's not about the individual, it's about the group and the group effort. And that was, you know, it's very touching.
As we talked about a little bit earlier, you also worked as an actor, or still work as an actor, and also as a voice actor. Can you talk a little bit about working, quote unquote, just with your voice? It's not such an easy feat as people always imagine it to be.
Yeah, so voice work, I think, is like most of sound work, is actually more modest in that respect, because, you know, it's not you out there. It's kind of you, but you know, people aren't going to see your face, and to be honest, in 99% of the cases, no one's going to know your name, and it doesn't really matter. I find voice work kind of very freeing in that respect. Like I say, I think I'm probably not the world's best actor, but kind of voice work, I've done loads of it, and I've enjoyed it very much. And certainly the work that I enjoy most is animated work, because there's kind of no limits to what you can and can't do, to the voices you can do, and it's really just about that kind of pure thing. And I kind of like the thing of when you're in the booth and it's kind of all dark and you can turn the lights, and you can even kind of shut your eyes and do it. And it's just like, so it's, by reducing it like that, you actually go into a total freedom of like just serving the thing. I think for me, for audio, is actually also a very pure form, because comedy especially is a kind of musical relationship to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy, you know, when the audience laughs, they are responding with sound. And there's a very specific timing about how, you know, a gag works, the build up and the punchline, and how the sound of the audience reacting comes in relation. And it's a musical relation. It's music. And the punchline, laugh, you know, it works musically. So that is sort of really, I'm an absolute timing fetishist. And in animation, weirdly, because it's such a visual medium and everybody can draw perfectly, the strange and beautiful thing about it is you actually kind of make it back to France. So you start with the sound. So you start with a radio play. So on Stitchhead, back in the beginning where we had no money and no time, I literally ran into a sound studio and recorded the entire script for all the storyboarders who were beginning work on it. doing all the voices, but just so that, you know, you take what is a script and, you know, so it's like 90, 100 pages of this weird courier font, you know, and everybody says they can read a script and most people can't read a script. It's not, it's just quite a difficult, weird thing to do to read typeface and to see a film. Theater and stuff like that, you begin to see, okay, that's a gag and that's how the timing is, and you can kind of try to indicate it a little bit with the spacing and a couple of parentheses, but if you describe it in too much detail, you kind of loses its flow anyway, so it doesn't. But if you can take that script and then put it into a little radio play, then people, and then they kind of get it. All right, okay, he's fast but he's slow, and then and here we're all excited and this is a sad scene. You know, you can get all of those differences just in narrating it. So that by going into audio, it feels to me that actually that's kind of 90%. It's the part of the iceberg which is kind of underwater. That audio is the thing we don't really notice.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like the music in a film, you know, if it's working really well, you often don't even notice it, but it's kind of working on you all the time because it works. Audio sound speaks directly to our subconscious. You know, that we kind of feel it in our gut, in our back and in our spine as much as in our brain. Whereas, like, if I sort of stop a film at any moment, I say, what are you getting right now? People will talk about the picture. But 90% of what we're getting is that audio. So it seems to me that that sound sort of world and that soundscape is so much of really what a film conveys. And yet, we don't notice it so consciously, and maybe that's why it's so strong. I really enjoy that, and that was kind of what I brought to the mix on the film, because like everybody else, they're so good at drawing, and I'm really not very good at drawing. And when I was at school, in England back in the day when I was at school, you did O levels and A levels. You did O levels like when you're about 15 and A levels when you're about 17, and I did O level art. And, you know, I got my results back from school for my O-levels. And, you got good in English, very good. Good in maths, very good. You got an A in art. You know, my dad was, it was almost like he was disappointed. And I said, yeah, I quite like it. I quite like to do art for A-level. And he said, you can't get a work with art? And actually, it would have been the one A-level. It would have been really, really useful for me. Going on into animation, so I ended up doing maths and English and history or something, you know. But I didn't do art, which I regret. So kids, if you want to do art, maybe it will be useful. Don't listen to your parents. But what I do bring is, though I can't draw because I didn't do A-level art, I did kind of bring that kind of audio experience of kind of how the jokes work, because in the end, the jokes are 90% or more for me actually sound. It's about timing, and you hear timing in the sound. It's like music.
Yeah.
And then to kind of make that melody kind of work to flow, that's kind of a really cool basis. And then you can put all the visuals on top.
Okay. Well, I have a few rapid fire questions for you at
the
end.
Sorry. My answers haven't been rapid fire. I'll try to speed up. Yeah.
No, we're perfectly fine. Is there a particular story that you would still like to tackle? You can just say yes or no.
Yes.
Okay. What would you say is the biggest misconception about the work of a director and writer? Can be just for animation or can just be that in a general sense.
Well, both, that it's glamorous. Like 99% of this work, like everything else, is logistics. It's just like organizing yourself, getting it done, getting stuff done. I'm, as a director, especially, like there are 85 people who need to ask you a question and you've got to like give answers to all these things. I love the storytelling, but there's just a hell of a lot of logistics and you shouldn't forget that.
Okay. You've been at this for a few years. How has the work changed over the course of the years? And that can be an external change or an internal change, as in how you approach the work?
It's changed externally more than it's changed for me internally. The barriers to entry are now very low. You know, since the digital revolution, like, it's amazing that with a phone, you can make a film now.
Yeah.
The barrier is the barrier to distribution, to getting seen. In the end, you know, what these big studios and whatever bring is the chance to get eyeballs on your movie. Obviously, you know, to produce to a very high level, then more resources are needed and more money. anybody can make a film now. And the big threat or the big, you know, potential change is how AI is going to change things. And I think a lot of the studios, they would really like to do away with the creatives. Streamers are buying big studios with lots of IP. The idea will be to kind of feed the IP into the AI and feed the AI into the IP. And it will become kind of this snake, it eats its own tail.
Yeah.
It's hard to see how originality will work then. But there's been a sort of a long history of kind of like, there's the big commercial stuff, and then someone's done something interesting sort of outside the commercial realm. And very quickly, it's gobbled up and becomes incorporated into the commercial realm as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in the end, you know, what matters is what moves us. And of course, if things have been gobbled up and digested enough, at some point they just become cliche and it just feels like a rehash of things we've seen again and again and again. And, you know, in my mind, that's a sort of creative crisis which kind of reappears again and again and again. Everything feels kind of like, done it before. Yeah.
The final question, can you share which project you are or maybe will be working on next?
No. I was just involved in doing the dialogue, directing dialogue for the Oshis, Oglies.
Yeah.
Film two. The Oglies are cool. They like dirt and mess.
Okay.
And trash.
All right. And that was it. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today, Steve. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Deep Dive Genre is produced by German Films, the National Information and Advisory Center for the Promotion of German Films Worldwide. To find out more about our guests, check out the links in our show notes. To stay up to date with our episodes, subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.